drone laden with explosives targets the residents of Iraq's prime minister in Baghdad in what the military has called an attempted assassination. Iran says Washington's claim that it's seeking negotiation and an agreement with Tehran is in contradiction to its so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. And COVID cases and deaths are hitting all-time highs in several European countries. The WHO says Europe is once again the epicenter of the pandemic. Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in to World News. A drone laden with explosives has targeted the residence of Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadimi in Baghdad's Green Zone. A statement from the Iraq's military called the attack an attempted assassination. However, it added that Khadimi escaped the attack unhurt. After the incident, Khadimi announced in a tweet that he is fine and in good health. He also called for calm and restraint from everyone for Iraq. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack. Iran says the U.S. cannot carry on with its failed maximum pressure campaign and economic terrorism against the country while claiming to seek negotiations and an agreement at the same time. In a phone call with its Chinese counterpart, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian expressed hope that the U.S. and Europeans will take a realistic approach to the upcoming nuclear talks in Vienna so a deal could be achieved swiftly. Wang Yi said the U.S. is chiefly to blame for the embattled status of the 2015 nuclear deal, expressing hope that the U.S. will make amends by removing all anti-Iran sanctions. Top Iranian diplomat also had a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran will return to full compliance with the accord if the U.S. fully implements its obligations and refrains from making demands outside the scope of the deal. Amir Abdollahian, however, pointed to the recent U.S. sanctions against Iran's drone program, saying that Tehran is skeptical about Washington's motives. Sergey Lavrov said that all sides need to resume the implementation of the deal, with the U.S. having to do so first. Political commentator Tony Gosling says that Washington must re-enter the Iran nuclear deal by removing sanctions against the country.
The United States always seems to be trying to squeeze more out of this apple, more juice than is actually in there. But what they do, I mean, they do this many, many times. And I remember a couple of years ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that the United States is not deal ready. It's basically saying that if you're sitting down to try and negotiate, in a way, you're wasting your time. Now, I think, you know, this is what we have to do. You've got to always try and negotiate. But it was really a great breakthrough for the world when the JCPOA was signed by President Obama back in 2015 with Iran. And this, what it did is it blocked out the Israelis. The Zionists really want to actually start conflict in the Middle East in order to drag the Americans in into the Middle East. So what needs to happen is the United States must go back, re-sign the deal with all of the other participants. As the sanctions begin to be lifted around the world against Iran, so that seems to be obvious. A child can see that is what needs to happen if the US is serious about this deal. As Biden promised last year before he was elected, that he would re-sign this deal and he would put it back together.
Palestinians have laid to rest the body of a teenage boy killed by Israeli forces during clashes in the West Bank city of Nablus on Friday. Mohammed Dadi succumbed to injuries he sustained after he was shot in the abdomen in the village of Beit Dajan. Many others were also injured in the clashes that, after protesters threw rocks at Israeli forces in an area to voice their anger at the regime's settlement construction, troops responded with live fire. The Palestinian towns have been the scenes of protests for months over the regime's settlement activities and planned evictions of families from their ancestral homes. Dozens have been killed and many more wounded in the Israeli crackdown on protests this year. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, for the latest on the killing of the Palestinian teenage boy by Israeli forces.
Well, anti-Israeli settlement protests continue to take place almost on a weekly basis. On Fridays, following Friday prayers, Palestinians take part in demonstrations and protests close to the illegal settlements to demand the Israeli regime stop settlement activity and evacuate the illegal settlement. What happened yesterday is that during a protest in the village of Beit Dajan near Nablus, in northern occupied West Bank, Israeli forces opened a fire and shot 13-year-old Muhammad Dadas from the refugee camp of Askar. It took place in Beit Dajan. He was transferred to hospital. However, the doctors couldn't rescue his life, and he succumbed to his injuries. Others were wounded in Beit Dajan, in Beita, in other places near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, also during demonstrations. Today, thousands of Palestinians took part in the funeral processions of this Palestinian child, Muhammad Dadas, in the refugee camp of Askar in Nablus. They vowed to avenge the killing of this Palestinian child, and they also said they would continue anti-Israel activities, and they would continue to take part in the protests and demonstrations that took place against the Israeli settlements.
Israel's prime minister says the regime will oppose the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in Al-Quds.
There's so much more we agree upon with our American friends than we disagree upon, but indeed, our position is, and it was presented very clearly and openly to our American friends, that there's no room for another American consulate in Jerusalem.
Naftali Bennett suggested such a mission should be opened elsewhere in the occupied West Bank. Consulate was shut and merged with the U.S. Embassy under former President Donald Trump in 2018. The Trump administration also recognized Al-Quds as Israel's capital and relocated the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to the illegally annexed city. The move has sparked outrage among Palestinians who deem Al-Quds the capital of their future Palestinian state. Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock in the Hodeidah port. In a statement, the company says a Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. War has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure. UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation in the country the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has condemned a new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. Senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has your story.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, Al-Houthi said the arms sales once again prove that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden have no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war in Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime
and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
COVID cases and deaths are hitting all-time highs in several European countries. The World Health Organization says Europe is once again the epicenter of the pandemic. Ukraine reported a record 793 deaths and over 25,000 infections in the past day. Meanwhile, Russia registered its highest ever daily infections with 41,300 new cases, along with 1,190 fatalities on Saturday alone. Greece has been breaking its daily infection record nearly every day this past week. This has prompted authorities to issue testing for those unvaccinated twice a week. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany witnessed another rise in cases, reporting over 34,000 new infections and 142 deaths over the past 24 hours. UK is also witnessing cases soar, with nearly 30,700 daily cases and 155 more people succumbing to the disease. Sudanese anti-coup protesters are prepared to launch a two-day civil disobedience campaign in Khartoum. Organizers have urged people to set up barricades on the main streets on Saturday. Civil disobedience will be held Sunday and Monday. Under the slogan, "No negotiations, no compromise, and no power sharing," protesters have rejected any new settlements between the military and civilian leaders. On October 25th, the military detained the civilian leadership, dissolved the government, and declared a state of emergency that sparked days of deadly mass protests across the country and a chorus of international condemnation. Since the coup, multiple mediation efforts have been made for a political settlement between Sudan's military and civilian leaders, but no sign of a breakthrough yet. The United States has ordered all non-emergency diplomatic staff to leave Ethiopia amid a spiraling conflict in the North African country. And the U.S. has also joined a host of other nations in urging all of its citizens to get out of Ethiopia. Now, this is a day after nine rebel groups announced they will be joining forces with the Tigray People's Liberation Front to overthrow the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Ahmed sent troops into Tigray last year to fight the TPLF and proceeded to announce a victory shortly afterward. But the Tigrayan forces have reclaimed their lost territory and even captured other government-held areas. The conflict has claimed thousands of lives and pushed many more to the brink of starvation.
Tensions are simmering in Ethiopia, where a year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, eight rebel groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the reestablishment of public services, among others.
The Ethiopian conflict has claimed over 100,000 lives and displaced more than 2.5 million people. According to the United Nations, some 7 million people north of Ethiopia are in dire need of humanitarian aid. About 400,000 people who live in Tigray alone are believed to be living in famine-like conditions. And despite the Ethiopian government's promises, humanitarian access to the crisis-hit regions has been strictly limited. Now, over 100 people have died in a fuel tanker explosion in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Authorities in the West African nation say the incident occurred in a very densely populated suburb late Friday. Dozens of people have been injured and transferred to hospitals. Several are in critical condition. That's according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Freetown's mayor has cited a collision with another truck at a busy intersection as cause of the incident. This is the second major fire in the fire incident in the capital this year. Back in March, over 1,000 people lost their lives in a fire which engulfed the city's slums.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The recent Kabul drone strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing at the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the airstrike as a success and preventing a second attack on U.S. forces at Kabul airport. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Larrison, a contributing editor and weekly columnist for antiwar.com website. The piece is titled Shut Down the Drone War. the 29th of August, U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, demonstrates the bankruptcy of the so-called war on terror. Like many other drone strikes, the strike in Kabul targeted innocent people and achieved nothing except to blow up civilians that had the misfortune to be in the vicinity. According to 2 recent investigative reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post, the vehicle targeted in the airstrike carried no explosive whatsoever, and the car's driver was Zamari Ahmadi, an aid worker who had spent the day delivering water to those in need. Hailed as a righteous strike by the U.S. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Kabul drone strike was an atrocity that should never have happened. The Biden administration has emphasized that the U.S. possesses over-the-horizon capabilities to continue waging war in Afghanistan even after the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from the country. But the 29th of August airstrike shows why the U.S. should not be using them. The recent Kabul strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing of the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the strike as a success in preventing a second attack on U.S. forces. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. As Ahmadi's brother, Amal, told the New York Times, "All of them were innocent. You say he was Daesh, but he actually worked for the Americans." The U.S. military has defended the airstrike, but all of their specific claims fall apart under scrutiny. U.S. officials claim there was a secondary explosion that proves the explosives were present in the car, but according to investigative reports, no such second explosion occurred. The objects that they believe to be explosives were in fact water containers. Despite surveying Ahmadi for 8 hours on that day, they managed to get every important detail wrong about what he was doing, who he was with, and what he was transporting. The killing of these 10 innocent people is an outrage, but the bigger outrage is that this strike is not an outlier. Things like this have been happening in Afghanistan as well as in other countries for years, but they have received little or no attention. When these attacks take place in remote areas, as they often do, it is difficult for investigators and journalists to determine what really happened. Because the strike occurred in a major city, there were lots of witnesses and journalists could piece together the evidence much more easily. Who knows how many other innocent people have been targeted in the same way that Zamari Ahmadi was? How many people have been executed like this, simply for going about their daily business? Who seriously believes that this has anything to do with the security of the United States? Thanks to Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we now know that the U.S. drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases, most or all of the victims are actually civilians. As Daniel Hale has said, with drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Many of the people targeted by drone strikes are not necessarily even militants, but just happen to be military-age males. Because the military wrongly assumes that everyone killed in an airstrike is an enemy combatant, unless proven otherwise, the number of civilians killed by U.S. drone strikes is bound to be considerably higher than the government acknowledges. The military has actually made a habit of either not counting or undercounting the civilian victims of U.S. airstrikes and drone strikes. The U.S.-led bombing campaign against Daesh in Iraq killed many thousands of innocent civilians, but the military acknowledged only a very small number of these. Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal reported in 2017, "We found that one in five of the coalition airstrikes we identified resulted in civilian deaths, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. It is at such a distance from official claims that, in terms of civilian deaths, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia have killed dozens of civilians, but U.S. AFRICOM Command has acknowledged only five. The Kabul airstrike fits into this pattern. 10 people were killed, but the U.S. military owned up only to killing 3 adults. Drone strikes have served as the background noise of U.S. warfare for the last decade and a half, and as such, they are mostly ignored until they cause enough loss of life to register briefly under radar of Western media outlets. The drone war has continued across 4 administrations, and in recent years, the conduct of that war and the casualties that it has caused have been increasingly difficult to track. If Americans had a clearer view of who the victims of drone strikes really are, more of us would realize that the drone war needs to be shut down. It is not making the U.S. any safer, and even if it were doing so at the margins, it comes at an unacceptably high price in terms of innocent lives lost. No government has the right to do what ours did to these 10 people in Afghanistan, and there is no justification for continuing a policy that regularly results in such slaughter.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio our two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum and Sayyid
Mohsen. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the recent events which took place in Afghanistan. You know, 2-3 bomb attacks happened in the Friday prayers in the mosques, and the Shia minorities have been attacked, which resulted in the death of a large number of the faithful worshippers, you know, and it really saddens all the Muslim and the Shiite communities in the world. You know, what's happening is that now the world expects Taliban, who is in power, in order to prevent the recurrence of such tragedies in Afghanistan and to punish the perpetrators of these, you know, attacks. But the case is that the Taliban itself used to do such actions before against the Shias, and now the question is how the Taliban and the Daesh, the ISIS, can bear each other in Afghanistan, because now the Daesh claims the responsibility for the bomb attacks and the Taliban is in power. Sayyid Murtaza, how they can manage this, and how do you think that Taliban can really change its behaviors against ISIS or Daesh?
Well, you know, Taliban's presence in Afghanistan since 2001, after the 9/11 attack on Twin Towers in America, they have carried out, they have planned, they have even recruited some of these suicide bombers. And they carried out the same attacks over the past 25 years. And now ISIS-K claims such a brutal act, and they claim that they were responsible for these killings. Wantedly or unwantedly, Taliban is in power, and the international community expects Taliban to provide protection for and to all minority groups.
Okay.
So they cannot, Taliban cannot say that they are weak. They have just been in power for a very short time. They need time. They need support from the international community. Unfortunately, Taliban know very well that these suicide bombers have been trained, financed, and supported for a specific killing operations across the country. So Taliban must come to understand that if they want to have a sustainable governance ruled by themselves, they must show their respect to the international community, human rights, the rights of minorities. Otherwise, they will face the same problem as they faced after the 9/11 attack in the year 2021.
Yes.
So Taliban must do whatever they can
yes.
to provide protection by all means.
Yes.
So providing security and protection for minorities, it must be their first top priorities.
So what about the similarities of ideologies between ISIS and Taliban?
So we cannot ignore that the Taliban and ISIS-K and ISIS in general have the same roots.
Mm-hmm.
Both are somehow called Takfiri groups,
yes.
and they are going to enjoy their similarities. Unfortunately, I'm very sorry to say this, that Taliban and Daesh have been considered the same by the Afghan nation.
Oh.
And on the other hand, we have international communities. Now neighboring countries to Afghanistan know Taliban as a terrorist group, and ISIS-K for sure is the same as
yes.
Taliban. So there is no big... I cannot actually draw a differentiation line between Taliban and ISIS-K ideologies.
Okay.
They have the same kind of ideologies, probably their means, their targets, and the way they treat other minorities might be different from time to time.
That's all right. Okay, Said Mohsen, what about you? Islamically speaking, from the point of religious point of view, and the jurisprudential point of view, are ISIS and Taliban the same?
Well, obviously, their action shows that they're following the same ideology. And the things that we have seen through the history that were done by the Taliban towards the Afghan nation,
yes.
I don't want to really use the word minorities because, when we talk about a country, for example, if a person, whether it's a black, white, Asian or anything, if he has the nationality of that country, he's the part of that country.
Yes.
So the main thing which we are missing here and which Taliban and other groups are missing in Afghanistan is to see Afghanistan as a country and the people who are living there as their own part. This is a big thing which they're missing. If Taliban thinks every single Afghanistani to be like the person who's living there as an Afghan national,
yes.
then obviously they will not do such things.
That's
but unfortunately, history has shown us that when the Taliban wasn't in power, they were doing the same actions
mm-hmm.
against the Afghan nation. So I don't want to use the minorities or
yes.
the names of the groups. Rather, I will use the word that the Afghan nation.
Yes.
So they did the same thing against the Afghan nation. Now when the Taliban is in power and Daesh has nowhere to go, and obviously the Americans through Turkey, even on the 14th of October, it was this statement by Putin that Putin has said that the America has brought many Daesh groups into Afghanistan through Turkey. So it's according to their own sources,
yes.
which they have, the Russian sources. So they claimed that the Daesh groups have existence in the Afghanistan. So now when Taliban is in power, and if Daesh is doing such an activities in order to get the power from Taliban, obviously they are trained to take power of a country. Obviously when they have their existence in the Syria and in the Iraq, it was to take power.
Yes.
Now when they're in Afghanistan, they will obviously strike for the same
yes.
aim,
okay.
for the same goal that they have.
That's right.
Now, jurisprudence, if you like, juristically, if we talk, there we can say like beliefs are the same. There is no change in them. The only change is that Taliban is now in power and it has responsibilities. It is answerable to the world because it wants the obviously the ruling or rulership of Afghanistan. It is aiming to aiming to rule over Afghanistan. So unfortunately, he has to back up from some of its, can say like beliefs that they have. The way in Saudi Arabia, obviously, they are the Shias, but yes. They're in a hidden situation. But Afghanistan's situation is changed.
Yes.
Now, juristically or like ideologically, they both are the same. Daesh is a bit extreme, we can say, like, if we want to like differentiate between both of them. Is the new version who were well-trained, who were trained by Americans and were imposed on Syria and obviously Iraq. And the your countries also, obviously, they backed this ISIS group. So we don't see any differentiation between them, as brother has said, like
although
the Afghan nation.
Unless they claim
the
that
only
they
thing
are
is,
different, okay?
Yeah, the only thing is they're two different groups.
Yes.
You know, within Daesh, we have seen in Syria and Iraq as well that those, within Daesh groups, there were different groups who wanted to rule and they have their own caliphs.
Yes.
You know, and then they had fight amongst each other, and they wanted obviously have control over other groups. The same thing is happening here now. But what I think is, I think Daesh is more in power than Taliban in Afghanistan because the way they are trained, the Taliban is not trained that way.
Really? Is it so, Said Mirza?
Because,
you know,
they fought in Syria, they fought in Iraq. They were having, the new weapons were given to them.
Yes.
Logistically, the training that they had, the weapons they had, the use of weapons, the ideologies which were given to them. Because Afghan Taliban has existence only in Afghanistan. If they were in other countries and then they were coming back to Afghanistan, that was another case. Whereas Daesh was in Iraq, it was in Syria, now it's in Afghanistan, they have their own existence in Pakistan and other countries as well. So they have more experience.
Say Mirza, this is really a good question because Daesh has not been successful in Syria and in Iraq, and they have been evacuated because of the opposition of Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies over there in the region. Now, I think the Taliban governance might be a good chance for Daesh in order to find its presence again in the region in Afghanistan. Is it so?
Well, Daesh, especially ISIS-K and Taliban, have no big difference. The only difference is the approach they choose to treat their targets. So I might disagree with some statements my brother made here.
Okay.
Many Taliban fighters, I can call them some Afghan nations, have been taken from Afghanistan through Saudi Arabia, and they have been sent to Yemen now, and some of the Afghans are still fighting in Yemen. So many Taliban soldiers have been trained outside Afghanistan, like ISIS-K. So Taliban and ISIS have some military similarities. They have been outside Afghanistan for many years. We know that Pakistan provided a very strong and good training camps for Taliban over the past 25 years. And Taliban, have fought a very long war in Afghanistan. ISIS doesn't have such a, experience in war. The biggest war that ISIS were directly involved was the war in Syria and Iraq. And we know that the Islamic, actually, coalition, including some countries around Syria, helped Syria to take out ISIS from Syria. And we know for sure that Taliban have been satisfied from their training camps, military assistance, and financial assistance that was provided over the past 25 years by some countries. So I think Taliban is not very much different from ISIS. And ISIS-K soldiers in Afghanistan are not going to be very much as strong as the Taliban forces are. As my brother mentioned, Taliban fighters or soldiers are the Afghan nationals. They know very well the ground. and they are fully familiar with the geographical situations of the sites of the country. But ISIS soldiers doesn't have such experience and knowledge. ISIS K soldiers are going to suffer lack of such a knowledge that the Taliban forces have. ISIS is not going to be as much active as Taliban forces were in the past. So I think let's see what happens, because now Taliban, as a terrorist group that was fighting the ex-government, is in charge. Now ISIS is going to face the Taliban as the ruling power in the country. So I think this is a political game. To me, it's more of a political game, and I think in future... future will tell us more about their presence.
Just one thing to add. Obviously, there is a something missing in the statement. And the thing which we are missing is that when we're talking about ISIS, it does not mean that there's surely some foreigners coming into there. Obviously, when we're talking about Afghanistan, there are the Afghans part of ISIS who will be leading the ISIS in Afghanistan. Obviously, there are the Afghan nations who were the part of ISIS who went for, you know, war in Syria and Iraq.
Is it clear who are, for example, these suicide bombers?
On these grounds, they're equal. I don't see a change in between them. Like they are. On top of that, obviously, ISIS is, we know that, backed by Americans. There's nothing hidden in it. You know, the logistical help, the maps, and the, you know, the intelligence help which Daesh or the ISIS wants, America will definitely will provide them all these things. So that's true. Like, I accept that the future will decide what happened. But obviously, according to what we can see, like in the news and what's happening, that was an analysis which was provided.
So the case is that really, as Brother Murtaza said, you know, the final victim of this crisis in Afghanistan are the Afghans, you know. 20-year presence of a foreign power like U.S. had no fruits for them. You know, even the actors, actresses, and the singers that were affiliated with the U.S. ran away from the country in the last days, okay?
You know,
And from the other side, and from the other side, we have these, you know, extremist groups who got the power now in Afghanistan. Of course, they say we are changed, but we have to wait and we have to see what's happening in the future. But still, there is no clear situation in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, this Taliban is a kind of fundamentalist, extremist Islamic group. And they're going to impose their strict Islamic order on the whole Afghanistan. So, because we know they are fundamentalists, they believe on extremism. So they are going to rule the country according to and by their own, you know, orders. So I think anyone who is believing in the modern style of living goes against the Taliban's ideologies and principles. So as you mentioned, the singers, musicians, artists, these type of people are leaving the country. Why? Because the ideologies Taliban are going to impose on the whole country is not actually deeply rooted in the Islamic principles religion. So this is a kind of, it's a self-made version of the beliefs or Islamic beliefs that Taliban are following.
But so the big question is that are these artistic groups belonging to the very Afghan culture or no? From the from one side, they belong to the American style of life. From the other side, to the extremist style of is there no middle ground between?
Well, let me quote on one of the Taliban's speaker in an interview with an Afghan TV. He said that I will pay 30,000 to 40,000 Afghanis from my own pocket to singers if they don't sing. So what does that mean? It means that they are against all types of you know, entertainment. Even if they are not against Islamic rules. So Taliban is a group that is going to impose their own ideologies instead of Islamic ideologies. This is a little bit, you know, different. So their own understanding, their own interpretation of the Islamic ideologies principles is going to be imposed on people as what Islam says. And we know that this is not true.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Said Murtaza and Said Mohsen, for presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. We tried to discuss the recent crisis taking place in Afghanistan, and is really the Taliban changed? The answer might be we have to wait. And the on-the-spot answer is no, okay? But we have to wait and see what's happening in Afghanistan by the Taliban. And dear listeners, thank you much for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Afi amanullah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
To reduce building sector emissions and improve health and well-being, there is no more important place to start than the home. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Cosima Starr and Rebecca Ochong. The piece is titled Housing Buildings Are Key to Sustainable Development. The article has been published by the Asia Times. Transition to a low-carbon, resilient and sustainable society and economy, buildings and construction activities play a critical role as they are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. As a matter of fact, they are responsible for more than 38% of global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, higher than any other sector. To tackle buildings' emissions and pressing housing issues holistically, it is important to think and act across sectors and engage with all stakeholders. Pressing challenges like climate change, housing for all, environmental degradation, and health cannot be tackled one by one and in silos, but rather need to be approached in an integrated manner. This multi-solving is what sustainable consumption and production, or SCP, one of the keystones of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, stand for. At the fully virtual 8th Asia-Pacific Housing Forum, funded Switch Asia SCP Facility and Habitat for Humanity, taking place from 7th to 9th of December 2021, discussions among multiple sector stakeholders will be brought forward. The Housing Forum, with the theme Building Forward Better for Inclusive Housing, highlights the urgent need for building sustainable, affordable housing through inclusive approaches. Many developing countries must deal with the challenges of making adequate housing available, as well as climate change mitigation and adaptation in their building sectors. When carefully planned, mitigation and adaptation strategies for buildings not only can stimulate the growth of new businesses and jobs, but can also contribute to other development goals such as clean air, healthy environment, access to clean energy and clean water, and making cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. Among critical elements that deserves particular attention is the social dimension, as it is in housing that social inequalities are felt most deeply. Social inequalities have been evident during COVID-19 lockdowns, when the most vulnerable could not safely shelter in place because of a lack of decent, safe, adequate and affordable housing. When we talk about housing and health, no one should be left behind. That means tackling all the barriers in what we call the housing ecosystem. The housing ecosystem is composed by all the social norms, formal and informal institutions, and trends and events that influence how people act to make changes that they value in their housing situations. At the center of the housing ecosystem are people with their capabilities, vulnerabilities, voices, and influence. They are the ones who will make changes around their housing situations and who will define and realize the ways to improve their lives. Some Asian governments have already made commitments to provide adequate housing to all. This means homes that need to be affordable, safe and secure, and provide healthy living spaces, comfortable in terms of temperature, light, noise level and indoor air quality. This ambition should be the starting point for any intervention on reducing emissions. In its regional roadmap for buildings and construction in Asia, the Global Alliance for Building and Construction lays out the many benefits arising from tackling the climate change holistically, by putting human needs at the center, considering resulting social, economic, and health benefits. For example, improving access to clean energy not only solidifies climate commitments, but also leads to health benefits and poverty alleviation, as air pollution is reduced and employment is created. Community-based micro-entrepreneurs are needed to build and service decentralized renewable energy installations. The health impacts of switching to clean energy and green buildings are real. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that around 7 million people die every year from air pollution. Buildings and household air pollution can significantly increase the risk of both communicable and non-communicable diseases, including cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, pneumonia, stroke, and lung cancer. A holistic approach that puts human needs at the center is championed by the uptake of SCP practices. These encourage us to see all sectors as part of a human-built system that can and needs to be changed when joint societal goals, such as those formulated in the SDGs or the Paris Climate Accord are not being met. For example, updating building codes to integrate sustainability and climate change can also integrate mandates for non-toxic building materials, as well as standards for thermal comfort, light, noise, and indoor air quality, thereby preventing diseases and improving residents' well-being. All stakeholders must be involved to improve the climate impacts of a sector, and any intervention needs to consider its wide-ranging negative and positive impacts. This is particularly important for policymakers. While climate commitments may be long-term and made at the international level, developing solutions that are meaningful for living conditions and quality of life are immediate and highly local. Since 2007, a program has implemented 15 grant projects contributing to sustainable housing in South, Southeast, and East Asia. The program is also providing technical assistance to Pakistan on developing a green building code and to Kyrgyzstan on promoting energy efficiency in the construction sector. The Switch Asia Switch Off Air Pollution project, implemented in Mongolia, offers a practical example of how building and ensuring access to sustainable and healthy homes can improve public health outcomes, reduce inequalities, mitigate carbon, and improve urban sustainability and resilience. To respond to the increasing levels of toxic air pollution in Ulaanbaatar, the world's coldest capital city, Switch Asia was initiated in 2018 to promote energy efficiency in Mongolia's housing sector. The project is working to increase community awareness on the importance of insulation and its benefits by promoting a step-by-step approach. This has been done by developing an affordable building retrofit of varying cost and efficiency for households based on the needs and financial capacity of individual families. Soap retrofitting solutions can save families up to 70% of energy costs if fully implemented. The benefits of these solutions include improved health, increased energy efficiency and increased comfort, extra savings from heating, and reduced workload from coal burning. Working towards these objectives, the project's team is active on the ground, connecting households with local construction workers, qualified suppliers, and green loans from financial institutions through a standardized delivery model that ensures the quality of the implementation and sustainability of the market mechanism. Capacity building of stakeholders of the delivery model is ensured continuously. Furthermore, the developed technical procedures of the project are included in the construction codes and standards of buildings, envelope, thermal insulation of Mongolia.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.